from Vision Australia Radio. It's time to open the cellar door and uncork a classic on Heard It Through the Grapevine.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm Michael Hintz, the velvety voice of Vino, with another Heard It Through the Grapevine on Vision Australia Radio and coming to you nationally through the Community Radio Network. Gee, I'm going at a pace this morning. And it's hello from my producer, Tristan Hodson. Today it's my pleasure to talk to the entrepreneurial agricultural scientist cum viticulturalist, the much-travelled Daniel Fischel, who in partnership with his winemaking wife, Michelle Edwards, is the driving force behind Linnea Vineyards. But before I introduce Daniel, a touch of nostalgia in When Everything Old is New category. I served recently a 2014 Barossa Pearl by Jacobs Creek the other night, and it received, it was served masked, an enthusiastic thumbs up reception from my dinner party guest. Launched back in 56, Barossa Pearl, and it was subsequently discontinued, I think, in the early 80s, but that helped wean generations of drinkers off port and sweet sherry and introduced them to the delights of wine in the 50s, the late 50s, the early 60s and the 70s. Somewhat like today's Moscato is providing the perfect introduction or segue into drinking wine. And in keeping with the nostalgic theme, I served a Scion 2012 Rose Muscat made by the innovative Rolly Milhinch in Rutherglen, which puts a modern-day twist on a very traditional tipple musket. It's a musket that is straight off, it's before it goes into wood and spends years in wood. A little like a musket de Baume de Vigny in taste. More in a future program on this. Anyway, now speaking of innovative, let's meet today's guest, the urbane scientist and flying not winemaker for a change. You thought I was going to say winemaker, didn't you? Yes, wrong. Viticulturalist, Daniel Fischel. Daniel, welcome to Grapevine.
Michael, thank you very much for having me on, and I'm still lamenting and wondering what happened to my dinner invitation.
Ah, well, I've got another Barossa Pearl in the fridge.
Very good.
You wouldn't remember Barossa Pearl, would you?
I don't believe so. No. It may predate myself.
Yeah. Yes, but Daniel's a bit younger than I am. Firstly, tell me about your background leading up to the creation of Linnea Vineyards and your partnership with your wife and business partner, and winemaker Michelle.
Absolutely. We took a rather long and tortuous route to get to where we are. I think torturous could also be a description of it. Originally from Sydney, I moved to California in the late 90s to do a PhD in plant molecular genetics. By chance, I ended up in a program working on ripening in grapevines. 6 years later, and quite sick of the lab environment, I yearned for the great outdoors, managed to get a job with an advising company in Napa Valley. And from there, joined a vineyard management company that was working with the what some might describe as the stars of the industry, the Screaming Eagles and the Harlands and Abreus and so on. A rather fortuitous position that I managed to attain. And
how did you get a green card to work in the States in the first place?
There's a young lady that came out of Washington, Michelle Edwards, who happened to be doing her second degree in winemaking at UC Davis, which is where I was.
Yes.
And she and I, we managed to get married, and that's how I managed to stay over there, yes. It was for love, not for the green card, but
right,
it's a nice side
had to ask
side that. Benefit.
Yes. So, and this led you to the creation of Linnea.
Correct. Yes.
So when was that founded? When did you get
started? Started in 2008. We'd both been working for other wineries, helping other people do well, and upon a whim, I guess, we decided one day that we would throw our hat in and delve in. Being resident in Napa Valley, we did have access to some amazing vineyards and opportunity to advise and construct high quality grapes. Michelle was working; she just designed a brand new facility and managed to leave a tank available for herself. So it was a natural fit to start the brand in Napa Valley.
And of course, being a flying winemaker and you're a flying viticulturalist, you virtually follow the seasons, don't you? You go to Italy, you spend time in America, you're in China quite a lot, so you have a global perspective on what's going on.
That's correct. It's
somewhat unusual, isn't it?
I think so, and it's a rather difficult escapade to keep up.
Yep.
You spend a lot of time in airports, a lot of time away from your family. That's certainly a downside, but the upside is you get exposed to pretty much every corner of viticulture in the world. You look at hot climate down to cool climate, soils from the extremely acid to the extremely alkaline, and everything in between. So from that perspective, it's been extremely invaluable.
You don't feel like Jekyll and Hyde occasionally, you know, when you come back to Australia?
We've been known to high-five each other in the hallway as we're off.
Yep.
One comes home, the other's off on a plane.
Yep. Now, take me through your current vintages. I believe you've got wine from Italy. You've got a magnificent Cabernet from the Napa, of course, in California. And closer to home in Heathcote, Victoria, where I believe you're involved in an innovative vineyard future-proofing project, and more on that later, from where Michelle has crafted a cavortingly opulent, now I lifted that somewhere, I don't know where I got that from, opulent Cabernet Sauvignon. Tell me about some of your current vintages.
Okay, so we are currently represented on three continents. Napa Valley was our original production, and that's the one that you just mentioned, and I believe you're looking to grab another one of those before we
Absolutely.
Leave the studio. In Italy, in 2010, we started a Barolo project, so we've been making Barolo for a number of years now, the sort of the disputed or perhaps undisputed king of Italian wines. We wanted a whimsical wine, and Moscato d'Asti seemed to fit that bill quite nicely. It's a pleasant drinking, low alcohol, lightly sparkling and somewhat sweet. Quaff, certainly an enjoyable wine. I've been known to have it before the hour is struck 12 and out of a beer glass. And from Australia, we started in 2011, we started the Arlequin, which is our Linnea Arlequin, which is our Heathcote wines. Into the future, we're looking to increase the wines out of Australia. We're looking to make some white wines. Riesling is on our radar.
Yes.
Probably Tasmania, possibly out west and into the corner of the country.
What, in Australia, back on the mainland?
Somewhere from Grampians back to Henty is the target zone.
Yes,
but
yes.
It all comes
lovely
down,
fruit coming from...
Right, it all comes down to the vineyards, I think.
Yep.
One of the things that we pride ourselves on is we have complete control over everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're from the generation that's overeducated and undercapitalized, so we don't get to own vineyards, we don't get to own a winery.
Does that cause any resentment by those that do occasionally, you know, that...
I don't think so.
No, right.
No, I'm not sure that lifestyle is particularly envious of others. The downside is that you have to work with other people's equipment, but we ensure that nobody touches anything. Vineyards, I'm an advisor on those vineyards that we get source fruit, so everything's done to the standard that I like to have them. And within the winery, Michelle sets up a no-step zone with lasers and alarms and all sorts
this
of things
all,
so that people don't touch any equipment. And
it works? People get the message?
Most of the time, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I usually have each week a wine of the week. So this week, I'm going to let you do a wine of the week. What wine of yours, this is a curveball, what wine of yours would you like to talk about and take us through?
One of ours that we've made or one that I drank recently?
No, one of yours, one you drank recently.
We're quite interested in a wine that's going to be coming out of Italy. I think over the next 5 years, you'll see a lot of it in Australia. Right now, there's only one producer that's arrived here. It retails around $100 a bottle.
Now, what's this wine
which
called?
Is about $80 over what it sells for in Italy. This is a variety of grape called Timorosso.
Timorosso, how do you spell that for the people?
Timarosso.
Timorosso.
No, it's Timorosso.
Ah, Timorosso.
Right.
Right.
It's grown in a very small section of the Alessandria Hills, a little bit south of the town of Alessandria in northern Italy, in northwest Italy. Only about 70 hectares currently planted, but from what I saw last week, it's quite feverish out there. We anticipate acreage probably doubling over the next 5 years. It's a well-received wine. It's made similar to Barolo. It takes a long time to get out.
So how does it differ? What's its unique, you know, what makes it so attractive and different?
Right. So early on, it has a fascinating minerality to it, a little bit of saltiness, like you might see in a Petit Arvin from Switzerland.
Yes.
And it's not as oily, as unctuous as some of the Rhone whites, but it has just a beautiful, rich characteristic, some stone fruit, some citrus. some perfumes that come off the top notes, if you will.
Yeah.
And the fascination with this wine is that the legal requirements are that it gets aged for 1 year on its lees on the on the junk at the bottom of the fermentation, if you will, in tank, in the winery. And it's rather unusual in that that's a legal requirement for the labeling system in Italy.
Yes.
Once it's bottled, that they recommend another two more years of just laying it down before you even begin to drink it.
Yes.
So early on, it has this these fascinating rich characteristics. Give them about 7 or 8 years in bottle, and they start to turn sherry-like. They start to show another level of profound aged characteristic.
Oh, right.
So it's a fascinating wine going from sort of young and sprightly through middle-aged, and then in its age, it becomes quite wise and savvy.
Oh, I wish I was like that. Isn't it nice we could talk about wine and age in a positive way, but when we talk to humans and we talk about us, age is, has a different connotation.
Sagacity in a bottle, no question.
Yeah, isn't it? Well, look forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
But of your current wines, which wine that, and you must tell people, please, where you can get these wines, because that's important. There's not much point talking about a wine unless what of your current vintages, what would you like to... is there one that is top of mind that you'd like to talk about, either the Napa Cabernet or the Heathcote?
I'm curious about the Heathcote wine. I'm curious to see what the public like to think of it. It's a wine that's been made in a style that respects Australian winemaking.
Now, this is a Cabernet, isn't
this
it?
This is a Cabernet-based blend.
Not a Shiraz, yes.
Correct. It's a Cabernet-based blend. It has some Petit Verdot dosed quite liberally into it.
How much Petit Verdot?
Well, it's wavered anywhere between sort of 4 and 15%.
Gee, that's a big
It's
tolerance.
A big chunk.
Yeah.
Right, and I think as we move into the future, we're looking to actually increase the percentages of some of the blender varieties into this wine. Merely because the market's curious right now, and the market's curious about alternative varieties.
Yes.
There's been a, in the last maybe 8 years within the Australian winemaking industry, we've seen a large percentage of wine, certainly from the smaller producers, go in all directions, sort of like buckshot going off, if you will, an explosion of confetti. Everybody's trying every variety at every in every region at every site.
Yes.
And I'm seeing, what we're seeing, we're about to see, is Darwinian evolution in its hurry-up state.
Oh,
I think over the next 5 years, you'll see a lot of those varieties sort of fade away pretty quickly.
Yes.
People will try them. There's interest. The sommeliers certainly love it.
Mm.
And they will, sitting in a restaurant, I'm sure you've been approached by a sommelier saying, try this alternative variety from this alternative site.
Yep.
But there's no question the Australian wine industry needs to adapt a little bit. It needs to start looking towards replacing some of the or maybe not replacing the heavyweights, but certainly offering an alternative to people who are a little bit sick of the same styles coming from the same regions.
Yes.
And with everybody trying everything, that's great. You'll start to see speciation in effect, and you'll see a few regions really start to stand out, and there'll be certain new varieties that'll start to come out of those regions.
That's a sign, I suppose, that the collective Australian palate is maturing, isn't it? It's just got out of the straitjacket and wants to experiment a bit. Overall, that's probably a good good sign, isn't it?
It is. And what you're seeing is that this is driven by a younger generation that's exploring wine like you've never seen. I think in previous generations, in their youth, they tended to gravitate towards beer.
Yep.
Wine is clearly the thing right now with the young generation. They are wine curious, if you will. And so these alternative varieties are quite attractive to them. I think the same rule applies. There'll be certain trends that will begin to pick up, and you'll see these trends move at a little quicker pace.
Yep.
The cycling of trends will certainly occur faster along the lines of the way they digest social media, I think.
Yes. I think Ross Brown of Brown Brothers said to me a while ago that in his experience, and this might be going back a bit, but a varietal has about a 15-year life cycle of popularity in terms of being fashionable. You know, he rates the wine industry akin to fashion in a way.
Sure.
That fashions come and go.
Absolutely.
But people, drinkers, don't appreciate that the growers and winemakers have to try and monitor those and plan for them. And you don't just pop a, you know, it takes a while for the grape to get from, concept into the glass, doesn't it?
Into the bottle. That's absolutely the problem, is that if you're willing to do a new development, for example, like we're this future-proofing project we're going to do in Heathcote, the cycle of preparing land, planting, and getting this fruit to just to first crop and then to maturity is about 5 years. Follow that with some winemaking and potentially aging in the winery. You may not see wines get out to the market till 6 or 7 years later. By that point, the trend may have evolved 3 or 4 times over. So it does provide somewhat of a conundrum.
And also the winemaker has to become confident in the handling of that grape. You don't it's like a first-year student. The difference between an SA and a first-year student and a PhD student, there's quite a lot. And we can't expect a winemaker to... I know Rick Kinsborough from Gioconda says this, and he's meticulous. You know, it's taken him all this time to master Chardonnay, for heaven's sake.
And add to that the fact that first-year crop, we often find that the fruit is exceptional. Yep. There tends to be a bit of a dumbing down for a couple of years as vines begin to mature. And then once you get into the 10, 12-year age on a vine, they really start to provide enhanced quality to the wine. So, yeah, there's clearly a dichotomy, and it's antithetical in the marketplace. But what we'll find is that there'll be certain regions that just shine, and that will become the new norm, the new trend.
What any regions? Can you give us an example here?
I can't, because I'm not Nostradamus. I can't predict what's going to happen. I know that when we do, and this is speaking from the our position, our company called Ear Trumpet Consulting, we're doing this future-proofing experiment. It's not really an experiment. It's a vineyard design in Heathcote where we're bringing innovation technology into the vineyards.
Well, tell us about this.
Sure.
By future-proofing, what do you mean by that?
We're looking at climate change.
Right.
Temperature rise, climate, global warming is not really something that's particularly difficult for grapevines to handle.
No.
You look at Chardonnay, it grows from the coldest climates to the warmest climates just fine.
Yes.
These are average temperature range of 10 degrees Celsius that it can grow just very comfortably. So we're not worried about temperature increase per se, we're worried about extreme events.
Right.
And that's where global climate change is going to cause significant problems. So what we're looking at is rebranding certain regions for novel varieties. And the example is Heathcote, which is typically a warm climate.
Yes.
We're looking at growing some of the hotter climate varieties in there. We're also bringing technology in.
So what varieties such as?
Portuguese varieties. I can't give away all the secrets just yet. That's some of the examples. We'll be looking at autochthonous varieties from other climates, warmer climates.
Said that word.
I won't be spelling it. I can show you that much.
Yep.
And certainly making sure that the soils are a match, that we're putting rootstocks in that are going to be able to deal with extreme environments. We've created algorithms that will allow us that under any given climatic event or climatic condition for a vintage, that we make sure that there's high-quality fruit coming off somewhere off the property. We'll be bringing in other innovations such as in trellising and training systems, mechanical dry farming. And then going one step beyond that, we're looking at the carbon sequestration program. It's been a little bit underserved in Australia. Farmers are loath to put in forests to get carbon credits because they have to maintain those forests for many years.
Mm.
So what we're looking at is we're looking at the vineyard as an entire ecosystem.
Right.
And we'll be putting in a cover cropping program to build carbon into the soil. We'll be looking to put native environments into the perimeters of the property so that we have a harmonious unit that can grow, that can precipitate carbon into the soils and at the same time sort of proof our vineyard against disease so that there are beneficial insects, we can reduce the sprays and so on. All of that will contribute to a positive carbon.
So this is creating a new template.
Right, that's what we're trying to do.
I think Peter Galen's in New Zealand's gone down that path too. Have you met Peter?
No, I have not.
Interesting.
Yeah,
you
New Zealand's a wild frontier I have yet to stick
my
toes into.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. So this, and people don't realise there's a lot of science and a lot of work goes behind this. And why should they? I mean, wine's made to enjoy and facilitate. It's only, I suppose, when you go up the wine wall in price to premium wines that people are more interested in their provenance and the effect of a terrarist, their sense of place. For most people, of course, wine is a bulk commodity, isn't it?
Oh,
you know,
I think it
slushes around the world in huge containers.
It does. It does. I've even had conversations with people who want their closure of choice to be a bag inside a container. I think that's the beauty of wine, is that it fits all people and it can fit all desires. The wine itself, there are several thousand varieties of grapevine, none of which have been explored in particular detail apart from maybe the big 20 or the big 30. So that's a staggeringly high percentage, you know, sort of in the upper 90s, that really hasn't been pushed to its limits.
Yes.
For our wine brand, for Linnea, we're creating wines that we love to drink. And so we're hoping to find like minds, to find kindred spirits. Those who love Barolo for its sense of place. There's a magic about Barolo that captures the castles on the top of the mountains and the soil and the truffles that come from the region, the Parmesan cheese and everything. It's the Napa Cab. It captures sort of the heat of California, the warmth
Does
of California in a bottle.
Does it ever. I had some of your 2009. Of course, it's delightful, drinking beautifully now, but I'd say it's going to be in its best to 7-10 years' time. It could live for, quite a long while.
I hope I'm long enough, around long enough to be able to experience that.
Oh, you will be. When you reach my age, you don't buy green bananas, I can tell you. Now, we're used to hearing about today's breed of entrepreneurial flying winemakers, but less so about the challenges inherent in being a flying vine doctor come viticulturalist, or as they say in California, a doctor of dirt. As a consultant viticulturalist, does that mean you do all the painstaking, detailed, hard work, but really get due recognition? Because the role of a consultant can be a bit tricky occasionally, can't it?
That's correct. We position ourselves in two ways. One is we want other people to look good.
Mm-hmm.
That's what our job is. We don't need the spotlight. We don't need the accolades. We just want other people to succeed. By that, we're succeeding. Our other job is to get ourselves fired as quickly as possible.
Yes, of course.
When you come into a property, you need to make an assessment. You need to see where things are going well. Yeah. You need to see where things are going wrong. Find ways to cut budget and still improve quality at the same time. It's no easy task.
No.
You get on board with that. If you can get a buy-in from the winery or from the vineyard owner, the important thing is to be able to enact the protocol that suits them best. And so now, you're really tailoring everything to the individual.
Are attitudes towards viticulture changing in Australia? Because really, we live in the era of the cult of the winemaker, and often the winemaker gets due recognition, but sometimes at the expense of the grape grower and the vineyard manager and the viticulturalist. There's not the same romance attached to that for some reason.
There isn't. Mm-hmm. When you start talking about glycine, betaine, aldehyde, you get a quick glaze over.
Yes.
We are science nerds. We do bring the science. We bring a lot of technology and science and innovation. We'll bring it to the limit of the people that are willing to adopt it.
And you're operating in a difficult environment. Because science and the word Australia are not compatible, are they?
Well,
you speak to Professor Chubb, the head of it's science is not highly valued on many fronts in Australia at the moment, so it must make it frustrating for you in to some degree in a broad context.
It's a challenge I like to adopt. I think the trick is to bring the science out to as much as willing to be absorbed, and then to hide it away again so that it does become the cult of the winemaker, or the grapes do express what winemakers like to call purity and sense of place and so on.
Mm.
So we do all the take care of the details to make sure nothing goes wrong and that we're maximizing the output from that particular site.
And at a day when we want instant recognition, there's social media and everything, and people's attention span is of a gnat. That's just very anti-cyclical, isn't it, or anti a trend. You know, you've got to stop people in their tracks and make them listen or understand what you're trying to do. That must be a real challenge. Apart from the science and itself.
Right, so we're not just about the science. We do take it a little bit further. You may have noticed our wine labels are quite enigmatic. They have an image that sort of blends the botanical with the science nerd. There's also the surrealism and Monty Python in a rather curious nexus. And Monty Python certainly shaped my childhood. There's no question about that. Even
our
consulting company, Ear Trumpet Consulting, not your typical agricultural science business name.
But branding is very important.
Right, and so we go into, we'll hit Instagram, we'll hit Twitter, and so on. And in those avenues, we like to put out things that are a little bit maybe controversial, but certainly a chance to explore some art, explore some Python-esque situations. And so,
but you've got to do that to get people's attention.
I think so, and you have to continually feed it. You'll get the classic cycle for Instagram is you put a picture out within within 5 minutes you're checking to see how many likes you get. It's an unavoidable consequence. It's what the generation does.
Yep.
And within, you know, within a day or day and a half, it's gone forever unless somebody's, you know, goes and looks through your profile. So there's a demand to consistently be in the face of the consumer and to provide them content.
Now, can that be at times a distraction or an annoyance from the core business of what you do?
Not at all. I think it's an important enhancement. What we're finding is that storytelling, rather than just putting a wine out there, putting out a product and talking about what, where the grapes came from, what the soil's like, the climate's like, people want stories. They want to know about the people behind the brand. They want something that captures their attention. Reality TV, if you will, from a wine bottle. And so we're beginning to explore that. We like to look into storytelling. Our wine names, they're in the Linnaean binomial system, but each of the labels, each of the brands is reflecting the people, a story about a forgotten person that is behind the wine, the a great-great-great-great-grandfather that owns the land or that established the land that the vines came from. Like, for example, the Barolo is called Linea Trifolau. That's the Piemontese word for the truffle hunter.
Truffle hunter, yes.
Exactly, and these are the secret people. There are the curious folks that come out at night. They've got their secret hunting spots. If you've come across them, they're just walking the dog. They're both... they'll be honest to your face and lie behind your back.
Oh, right.
They're fascinating people, and nobody really knows about their lifestyle.
Yes.
It's very unique. Yes. It's very individual to that place, and that's why we wanted to honor that in the wine.
So you're a real terroirist, because there's a battle going on. Is the glass half full or is it half empty in terms of individual wines or homogenized global wines? But look, fascinating to talk to you, Danny. And please do come back, because we've got a plethora of subjects. We haven't even got on to China. There's so much to talk about. Would you come back sometime and carry on this conversation?
Absolutely. I have a long list of stories from the wild frontier of viticulture that need to be heard by the public.
Well, Tempus Fugit, that's your lot for now. Daniel, thanks for your time today. It was a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope you'll return soon.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me on.
Good. And my research material is sourced from my home library, LinnaeaVineyards.com. This has been another Heard It Through the Grapevine on Vision Australia Radio, heard on stations all around Australia via the Community Radio Network. It's cheers from me, Michael Hintz, and please drink moderately.